Our first reading today is Luke chapter 22, verse 6 to chapter 23, verse 12. When day came, the assembly of the elders of the people gathered together, both chief priests and scribes. And they led him away to their council, and they said, "If you are the Christ, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I ask you, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God." So they all said, "Are you the Son of God then?" And he said to them, "You say that I am." Then they said, "What further testimony do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own lips." Then the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." And Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him, "You have said so." Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, "I find no guilt in this man." But they were urgent, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea from Galilee even to this place." When Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had long desired to see him, because he had heard about him, and he was hoping to see some sign done by him. So he questioned him at some length, but he made no answer. The chief priests and the scribes stood by, vehemently accusing him. And Herod, with his soldiers, treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then, arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day, for before this they had been at enmity with each other.
Jill, thank you for reading. And can I say hello? My name's Kev. I'm the vicar of Euston Church. It's so good to have you with us. Great that you've been able to join us for our Good Friday celebrations. This painting is over 400 years old. It's by an Italian artist called Caravaggio. It's called The Taking of Christ, and it's the scene we read about last Sunday, if you were here. Hands are important in this painting. Can you see lots of them? Not sure what's going on with the mad hands on the far left, but the betraying hands of Judas are there. Hands with lanterns lighting the way. And in the middle, in the dark, do you see hands seizing? They've been plotting to lay their hands on Jesus for ages. But look at his hands. Jesus is the ones down at the front. Clasped hands. Inactive hands. Unresistant hands. In the face of this injustice. And it all just feels very different from the dynamic Jesus that Luke has recorded for us in such an orderly way. Even before his birth, predictions of him visiting, reigning, helping. Then as a child in the temple, do you remember listening, asking, increasing in wisdom and stature? During his ministry, teaching, healing, feeding, calling, answering, praying, raising, forgiving, sending, foretelling, seeking, saving, setting his face to Jerusalem, commanding, directing events, even up to the very moment of his arrest. But now, seems to be the people all around Jesus who are calling the shots. And in that reading that Jill gave us, did you notice the way it felt like he was being just passed around the place like a piece of meat? Luke, the gospel writer, wants us to be certain about the things that were accomplished in the life and supremely the death of Jesus. There's been so much activity from the great action man, so much leadership that he has demonstrated, but now Jesus seems to be the one being led, having stuff done to him. Verse 63, playground bully boys holding him, mocking him, beating him, blindfolding him, asking him against him, blaspheming him. Prophesy, who is it that struck you? You know, the irony is, he prophesied this exact moment. See, we're going up to Jerusalem, and everything that's written about the Son of Man by the prophets will be accomplished. For he will be delivered over to the Gentiles and will be mocked and shamefully treated. Do you know, he even prophesied the precise moment that we read about in the very previous paragraph where Peter denied him. And yet, seemingly doing nothing now as he is led away by the religious bigwigs. Verse 67. If you are the Christ, tell us. But he said to them, if I tell you, you will not believe. And if I ask you, you will not answer. Well, that certainly fits the way their conversations went in the last few chapters, if you were here. Why would it be any different now? Verse 69, but from now on the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God. It's a glib cultural reference to compare this to, but in other words, if you strike me down, I'll become more powerful than you could possibly imagine. And yet again, seemingly doing nothing, the piece of meat shoved in Pilate's direction, and again, all the action seemingly driven by different players, bringing him, accusing him, blatantly lying in what they say about him. Jesus doesn't seem to defend himself. But they're very busy being urgent. Pilate thinks Jesus looks like something the cat dragged in, shoves him on to the next dignitary. Herod can deal with this one. Galilee's his backyard. Herod's been hoping to see some party tricks for a while. Go on, Jesus. Show us one of your best. But he does nothing. Answers nothing. And that first reading ends where it began. Enemies accusing him. Bully boys mocking him. Arraying him. Sending him back to the powers that be to have his fate decided like a piece of meat. Or maybe it would be more accurate to say like a lamb being led to the slaughter, just as Isaiah predicted. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that's led to the slaughter and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Jesus seemingly doing nothing here, but he is accomplishing everything.
The next reading follows straight on from the last. It's Luke chapter 23, verses 13 to 33. Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people and said to them, you brought me this man as one who was misleading the people. And after examining him before you, behold, I did not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod, for he sent him back to us. Look, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I will therefore punish and release him. But they all cried out together, away with this man and release to us Barabbas, a man who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection started in the city, and for murder. Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus, but they kept shouting, crucify, crucify him. A third time he said to them, why, what evil has he done? I have found in him no guilt deserving death. I will therefore punish and release him. But they were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified, and their voices prevailed. So Pilate decided that their demand should be granted. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they had asked, but he delivered Jesus over to their will. And as they led him away, they seized one Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, and laid on him the cross to carry it behind Jesus. And there followed him a great multitude of the people and of women who were mourning and lamenting for him. But turning to them, Jesus said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, 'Blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bore and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry?" Two others, who were criminals, were led away to be put to death with him. And when they came to the place that is called the Skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on his right and one on his left.
Thanks, Jack. In Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, a Jew called Jehohanan, who was in his 20s, committed a crime against the Roman authorities. We don't know what he did, but we know all about his punishment. He was crucified. Histories of the time regularly describe the practice, which was deliberately designed to make death prolonged and painful and public. This picture is the nail that was driven through Jehohanan's heel bone. It didn't literally have his name on it, but it was discovered by archaeologists in a stone box where his remaining bones had been gathered and his name was inscribed on the side. This is one of the only remaining pieces of physical evidence for that most notorious of Roman tortures. Barabbas should have ended the day with his heel looking something like that. There were nails that had been set aside that were due to crush themselves into the hardest part of his leg. And maybe someone was already lined up to gather his remains into a little stone box. But it never happened. Was Barabbas still in his cell when he heard his name being shouted? Barabbas! 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 Why are they shouting my name? Maybe they're shouting because they're glad about what's going to happen to me today. Perhaps they can't wait to see the spectacle. I am an insurrectionist, after all, a murderer. When his cell door was opened, he expected to be handed a cross to carry, expected to be led away. See, verse 32 should read like this. It should say, two others who were also criminals were led away to be put to death with Barabbas. And when they came to the place that's called the Skull, there they crucified Barabbas and the other criminals. But it never happened. It's quite a weird justice system, isn't it? Where if enough people shout your name loudly enough and demand some other innocent person's death urgently enough, that the judge would completely cave in and grant the mob's demands. It's a very strange system of justice. And so when the cell door did open, can you imagine Barabbas's sheer shock when they didn't hand him a cross? They handed him release papers. What? Well, I guess he didn't hang around long enough to ask any questions. But maybe on the way out of the prison gate, he turned around and noticed who was being led away. Wondered why. It was the great swap of places that had been predicted hundreds of years before. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Jesus was completely innocent. That is emphasized from start to finish in this chapter. Pilate declared it, the soldier at the foot of the cross announced that certainly this man was innocent. But are we sure? I mean, it was the equivalent of the electric chair crucifixion. Could anyone who'd had to endure such a fate be totally blameless? Surely something dubious about you if this had been your fate? And aside from the question of Jesus' innocence, could it be right that transgressors like Barabbas would go free, or transgressors like us? It's a very strange justice system, isn't it? Where an innocent person would die instead of you or me. Of course, in our case, the judge wasn't caving in to the crowd. It was his plan. Planned in such a way that the great swap would satisfy real justice. Him for completely undeserving Barabbas. Him for completely undeserving us. Can you hear your place in the great swap that was promised? Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. I sometimes feel sorry for Pilate, but he was pretty pathetic here, wasn't he? He knew Jesus was innocent. He played to the gallery and opted for an easy life. Their voices prevailed. It says he delivered them over to their will. What about Jesus' will? Not my will, he prayed a few verses ago. What about the Lord's will? Well, it was the Lord's will to crush him, to send a Roman nail into the Son of God's heel bone, a nail that had your name on it. Oh, the cross was no shambles. It was accomplishment time. Their will, not my will. It was the will of the Lord to crush him.
Two others, who were criminals, were led away to be put to death with him. And when they came to the place that is called the Skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. And Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And they cast lots to divide his garments. And the people stood by, watching, but the rulers scoffed at him, saying, He saved others, let him save himself, if he is the Christ of God, his chosen one. The soldiers also mocked him, coming up and offering him sour wine, and saying, If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself. There was also an inscription over him, This is the king of the Jews. One of the criminals who were hanged railed at him, saying, Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us. But the other rebuked him, saying, Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong. And he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And he said to him, Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. It was now about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour, when the sun's light failed. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Then Jesus, calling out with a loud voice, said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. Now when the centurion saw what had taken place, he praised God, saying, Certainly this man was innocent. And all the crowds that had assembled for this spectacle, when they saw what had taken place, returned home beating their breasts. And all his acquaintances and the women who had followed him from Galilee stood at a distance watching these things.
Thanks, Ellen. This picture is a depiction of Jesus on the cross. It was carved in the 5th century, and it's part of a series of small ivory panels that you'd find down the road at the British Museum. Together, these ivories form the earliest known depiction of the Passion narrative. And I don't particularly like the look of it, the picture of Jesus on the right there, but I do find it very interesting what it's trying to say. See, Jesus is presented here as buff and ripped. He's been given the physique of a victorious athlete, even kind of smiling, certainly satisfied in his facial expression. Is that wishful thinking? Do you know why that's one of the earliest depictions of Jesus' death? Because for the first 4 centuries after the event, the torture of the Son of the Most High God was thought to be too scandalous to be portrayed visually. It was only after crucifixion as a form of punishment had been banned that it was deemed an acceptable theme for artists. And that's hard for us to get, isn't it? We're so used to depictions of Golgotha. Hard for us to get our heads into the mind of Theophilus, who Luke originally wrote this gospel to. How over the top and just outrageous the cross must have seemed to him. How much a cause of doubt in the whole gospel. Especially given that it had been the temple professionals pushing for his execution. Could one so despised by the religious in crowd certainly be God's king? Well, Jesus may have looked passive in those earlier readings, but it becomes increasingly clear that here is the king very much in action, full of courage, integrity, innocence, self-control, strength, giving warnings to the daughters of Jerusalem, making predictions again about the future, passionate about forgiveness, his big purpose in coming, praying forgiveness for the very ones who were driving the nails into his heel bone. How's that for practicing what you preach? And the shouts and the inscriptions around him spoke so much more than they knew. The Christ of God, his chosen one. Yeah, actually. This is the King of the Jews. You've got it exactly. This crucifixion is a coronation lifted up to be enthroned. The Jews wanted strong leadership. The Romans loved a good warrior. He is all of that, but not the way you expect. Behold your king, people. He reigns from a cross. And of course, the king can't save himself precisely because he is active at work in this moment, saving others. And it's one of the most unlikely people in the scene who gets it. One of the criminals next to him trusts the king. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And he said to him, truly, I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. The king at work, again, seeking, saving the sinner, making promises out of all proportion and totally undeserved. What a day it turned out to be for this guy on the next door cross. First, a ringside seat as the Son of God dies for the sins of the world. And that criminal ends the day still alongside the king, only now in his paradise kingdom. Weren't you the lucky criminal, they probably said, to Barabbas? But which criminal at the scene that day really hit the jackpot on Good Friday? If we're honest about our own natural rebelliousness, which I hope we can be, aren't we the lucky criminals to have had the king's promises showered on us? Couldn't save himself in that moment. He was too busy saving you. And the Savior King is in victorious action right to the very last, his final breath, actively trusting in his Father's will. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Others had laid their hands on him. The king now entrusts himself into his Father's hands. He's quoting a psalm of the Christ, because trusting the Father to come good is what the Christ King always does. And in this final cry, it's as if he affirms his trust in everything that's been revealed in the scriptures about how God works. He trusts that descending before ascending is the Father's plan for the Christ King. He entrusts himself to a Father who will shame all opposition and every disaster, not simply by overcoming them, but by working through them to bring his great salvation. The Christ commits his spirit to a God who he is sure will accomplish his eternal purposes by the way of the cross. Will we take the King's lead in this? How's it going trying to join him in trusting that this is the path to paradise? Committing ourselves into the Father's hands? I wonder, as life happens to you, do you still trust that the Calvary road is the way the Father works for good? And will we join Theophilus on the path to growing certainty that a King who first suffers is not just our great hope, he's the great hope for our needy city and our broken world? Good Friday. It's not a funeral you've come to today. The clue is in the name. Good Friday. It's a celebration. And as we break bread and take wine now, it's a proclamation. Because the Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. A stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God, and Christ the wisdom of God.
Final prayer as we finish. Most merciful God, by the death and resurrection of your Son, Jesus Christ, you delivered and saved the world. Grant that by faith in him who suffered on the cross, we may triumph in the power of his victory through Jesus Christ, your Son, our Lord. Amen.